Welcome to this Good Lit podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California. The Good Lit series brings literary and culinary luminaries to the podium. I'm Gina Bellaria, Director of Literary Events at the club. To learn more about our programs or become a member, go to commonwealthclub.org. To take part in a discussion about what you hear, blog at commonwealthlit.blogspot.com.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley program brought to you from the Petit Trianon in downtown San Jose. My name is Dr. Meredith Rudolph. It is my pleasure to introduce author of Honeymoon in Tehran, 2 years of Love and Danger in Iran, and contributing writer for Time magazine, Azadeh Moaveni. Azadeh grew up here in San Jose, studied politics at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and received a Fulbright Fellowship to study Arabic at the American University in Cairo. Fluent in Arabic and Farsi, Azadeh has lived and reported throughout the Middle East. As one of the few American correspondents allowed to work in Iran continuously since 1999, she has reported widely on Iranian youth culture, women's rights, and Islamic reform. Her memoir, Lipstick Jihad, was published in 2005, and she co-authored Nobel Prize laureate Shireen Ebadi's memoir, Iran Awakening. Azadeh's work has been featured in numerous publications, including The Washington Post, The Wall Street Journal, and The Los Angeles Times. She currently lives in London with her family, and her newest memoir, Honeymoon in Tehran, 2 years of Love and Danger in Iran, chronicles her life after returning to Tehran in 2005. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Azadeh Moaveni.
Thank you very much for that kind introduction and to the Commonwealth Club for having me here. It's a pleasure to be back in my hometown. Thank you all for coming out and spending part of your afternoon with me. I have to apologize in advance for a terrible cough that I have, so I'm trying to minimize it with cough drops, and I hope not to inflict it on you too much. I'm very pleased to have the opportunity to go around the country at this particular moment to talk about Iran, because I feel like it's a unique moment in the last few years. It feels like there's a real conversation going on about Iran in this country right now, especially with a new administration in Washington who seems to recognize that the policy of the previous administration of ignoring Iran and belittling it seems to be an acknowledgement that that policy has failed. It has resulted really in Iran being empowered and hasn't led to any progress on the key issues of sort of mutual concern between Iran and the U.S. So I think it's a wonderful opportunity to sort of be able to go around the country and talk about Iran, because Washington is figuring out how to deal with this country, which makes it really important to talk about and try and understand the real aspirations and attitudes and beliefs of the Iranian people. I think we've seen in the case of Iraq how important it is to truly understand and to understand very deeply a country before going about setting out our policies. How are we going to deal with these countries in the Middle East with very complicated histories? So I think it's important to try and understand what Iranian society is really like. And it's particularly important, I think, in a state like California that does have also such a sizable Iranian-American population, because I think it's quite critical for the sake of the diaspora also that relations between Iran and the U.S., even if the sort of incredibly difficult and complicated key issues aren't resolved, that at least there is not this tremendous animosity, so that at least people can see their relatives, so the relatives can go back and forth, so that we can have cultural exchange. So it's an important time, and the reason that I'm here talking about Iran with you is because I've lived in Iran for several years in the last decade. I moved there in 2000 to 2000, and I lived there for 2 years through the end of 2001 as a reporter for Time magazine. That was my start, really, in journalism. And I wrote a book about those years called Lipstick Jihad, which is really a book about youth culture in Iran and how this very young population, about 70% of Iran's 70 million people are under the age of 30, likely under the age of 25. So a tremendously young population. And in my book, I tried to communicate because I felt like there wasn't really enough space in my news stories for Time and in the reporting that I was doing to really paint a portrait of this young generation and how they were so courageously, I thought, going about trying to transform their society from the inside. And I described it at the time, I described Iran at the time as an as-if society, where young people went about living as though many of the government's regulations simply didn't exist. Young women wore things that flouted the proper Islamic dress code. They wore bright colors, sort of pinks and bright greens, and things which were not really acceptable for many years in Iran. They wore their veils pushed back, and they showed a bit of skin, and sort of slowly, just in their mass numbers and in their persistence in doing this every day, forced the government really to tolerate a loosening up of the dress code. And you could see this kind of rebelliousness in every aspect of young people's lives, whether it was dating and holding hands on the street or in the park, or listening to banned Western music or watching banned movies, drinking alcohol at home, participating in the underground music scene or going to parties. Really, I felt as though they were trying to ignore the rules, sort of bypass them. And in doing so, they really effectively, I think, loosened up what life was like in Iran for themselves. They didn't do this through the political process because, of course, they're very disillusioned and feel that there isn't much space for actually changing Iran through government, rather through private behavior. So that was something that I chronicled in my first book. And I wrote about it not only in terms of young people, but also women, because I think that women were also at the forefront of this movement to bring about change in Iran through the private and public personal sphere. A lot of times when I go around the U.S. or if I'm on the radio, people will ask me, you know, how did you as a modern American woman, sort of born and raised in a free country, how could you stand to live in such a repressive place where women are so mistreated and life is just so incredibly difficult for women? Well, part of why I write about women in my most recent book and also in Lipstick Jihad is to communicate that although the government, yes, is incredibly brutal, is repressive, has discriminatory laws against women, women don't have proper rights to child custody, to divorce laws, and things are improving slowly in these areas, but obviously so much is left to be done. Even though that's certainly the case, that hasn't kept Iranian women back from participating in public life. They are at the absolute forefront of every sphere you can think of. They are making the most interesting films. If you open up the newspaper and look at a bestseller list of popular books, women will be at the top, writing about very taboo subjects like romance and relationships and sex and things that were not sort of acceptable subjects to be discussed publicly in books. Women are the most prominent painters in Iran. Iranian painting is now getting so much worldwide attention. And women are really at the forefront of all of this. So even though it's true that we're talking about a very repressive government that has made really a policy of trying to marginalize women from public life, women have not tolerated this. They have a very ancient, indeed a centuries-old tradition of being central to the arts and to politics, and they haven't allowed the government of the last 30 years to change all of that. So this is a portrait of Iran that I've painted in my work. And it came as a shock to the world in May of 2005 when a very conservative man, I think everyone's now familiar with his name, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was elected president. The question being, well, if Iran is truly this nation of very moderate and progressive young people who are secular in their outlook and want better relations with the West, how did they or why did they elect this man who has come to be known only for his fundamentalism, his defiance of the West, his denial of the Holocaust? It didn't quite square together. So I was sent back by Time magazine to sort of explain and write about how this had all come to be. How did Iranians elect him, and what did it mean? And in the course of that, first I'll tell you quickly how that did come to be. He ran on a platform of change, and I think in this country we're familiar with that notion. It will resonate with you here because we've recently had an election where people really felt like they wanted a profound change in government in all of the ways that mattered. And that was the approach that Ahmadinejad very cleverly used in 2005. He promised to tackle corruption. He promised to bring the country's oil wealth to people's dinner tables. He promised to be different than all of the other establishment candidates. And people really were attracted to that. And I think that it was very clever because most of the other candidates in that election they didn't pitch themselves to people that way. They were running on the youth vote. They were sort of going with the sort of trend in politics up until that moment, which was sort of the basic understanding that young people want more freedom, and so if you want to be successful in an election, you have to appeal to young people. So the other candidates had really attractive young women passing out banners for them on the street. They had carloads of sort of hip young people running around with the sort of their names emblazoned on the back. Their campaign headquarters were sort of blasting Western music, banned Western music, I might add. And really were targeting what was felt to be the sort of demographic that was going to drive the election. What had happened that this all sort of was... What contributed to that misjudgment? Well, the young people that I wrote about in Lipstick Jihad, who were all in their early 20s at that point and very concerned with things like dating and privacy and their parties not being raided, well, they were slightly older. They were in their late 20s some had come into their early 30s and were a little bit more, their concerns had evolved. They weren't as, although they were still concerned about all of those things, they were at an age where they were thinking about getting married. They wanted to move out of their homes and start sort of independent lives as married people. And so things like real estate and can we find an affordable apartment, jobs, can I find a decent job to support a family? Can I reach that sort of level of economic independence, financial independence that will help me be able to start a life outside of my parents' home? These are what that sort of slightly older baby boomer generation was thinking about in that year of 2005. And so that's how... And that's what Ahmadinejad responded to. And so his victory, and I, this is a theme in my book, and I sort of chronicle it, was not really because Iranians at the time were feeling defiant or nationalist or wanted to defy the West, but because they were hoping that he would improve their daily lives. So another thing that happened to me in the course of that election was I met my future husband, and I moved back to Iran. I was living in Beirut at the time, and I moved back so that we could get married and start our life together. And there's a chapter in my book that's devoted to all of this. It's called The Persian Bride's Handbook. For me, it was just a tremendous experience because I think, like many young people in Iran, you sort of float. You can float through, and I did my early 20s, not really absorbing the reality, the true realities of the Iranian economy and what life is like for young people who are at the stage of making these important life transitions. So I discovered a lot of sort of fun and colorful things in this time because we were going about planning a wedding, and I thought that this would be a pretty straightforward affair, and we sort of went around to wedding coordinators thinking, okay, well, we're going to find out how we can have a pretty standard wedding like everyone does anywhere else in the world. And the world of Iranian weddings in Iran just astonished me. These wedding coordinators were straight out of a Hollywood film. They would sort of they had PowerPoint presentations, and they had empires of sort of 10 different rooms. You would sort of be guided towards the catering room, where they would sit down and ask you, so do you want 13 or 17 entrees for your buffet? And you would sort of ask, well, could we have two or three? Would it be possible? They would say, no. That would demean my reputation. And then we would sort of be guided to the photography room, which was, of course, a sort of world unto itself. And couples were expected to sort of devote two whole days to their wedding photography. And you could go out into the desert and be photographed as you galloped off into the desert on horses or running around these ancient ruins or by the water or sort of meeting on a veranda as though you were sort of Audrey Hepburn in a movie, and this was some sort of gala ball. And then all of this would be woven together, of course, into a beautiful picture album, and at the end there was also the option of sort of dressing up as a flamenco dancer or sort of put into a DVD that would be set to music and that friends and relatives would then have to suffer through, sort of watching the couple go through all of these dramatic poses. And this sounds all quite outlandish, of course, but it was really what middle-class young Iranians aspire to. And I want to underline this point because I think that sometimes there's a misconception that this kind of extravagant, the desire to sort of have extravagant consumption or to be sort of showy in status is a sort of an upper crust Iranian phenomenon. Well, this was the middle class. These were ordinary young people who certainly could not deserve it, whose parents were going into debt to have these kind of weddings. And it became so the quest for a sort of big, lavish wedding, which I think is interesting because I think there's a parallel to that in this country, the quest for this had become sort of a public issue. There would be newspaper articles about it and, you know, why do we have a wedding crisis? And the government sort of at different times had tried to step in and address this. They were trying to encourage modest weddings, because it was recognized that this was sort of putting people into debt, that it was unhealthy to sort of be so preoccupied with displaying status in the community to sort of go into debt to have this kind of wedding. So the government tried to sort of address this in its modesty drive for weddings, and they had this party that that young people were invited to attend, provided that they committed to a modest marriage contract. And I won't go into the details, but in an Iranian marriage contract, a woman has to sort of put down a financial sum that she will be granted in the event of a divorce. And couples were sort of putting really outlandish things like my weight in gold or, you know, my birth year in sort of chunks of gold or things like this. Obviously, no one could afford to pay this. These young grooms could not. And so it was becoming a crisis. There were young men in prison because their young brides had decided to collect this money and they couldn't afford to pay it. And so to be able to attend the government's modest wedding party, you had to have a marriage contract that was sort of under a certain I don't know what the dollar equivalent, probably $1,000 or something. The woman's sort of what she could collect upon divorce had to be less than that. And so I read about it in the newspaper because I was excited about weddings at the time and reading about them. And the government party sort of sounded like an Islamic disco because they had sort of pictures of Islamic saints and martyrs from the war everywhere. And they brought, and this is meant to be a party, I remind you, festive. And they brought a mullah up to the podium to recite from the Quran. And then they brought someone to talk about the Iran-Iraq war and sort of try and make light of it. I don't know quite how that was intended to be. And then the partygoers were given a book on marriage written by the Ayatollah Khamenei, who is the supreme leader of Iran. And in this capital city of millions, 300 people attended, which is goes to show you how uninterested young Iranians were in both their government's attempt to encourage them to modesty and also to sort of put up with the government's attempts in any way to sort of teach them anything. So I'm going to sort of go from that to another thing that I experienced, because I think that all of these anecdotes, and I write about them as a way to illustrate both how Iranians are coping with their government and the society that's come about since the revolution, but also I think In these different ways, we get a sense of the Iranian government itself and how ambivalent it is about so many of its core principles, and how uncertain it is about how to respond to this young generation who is so frustrated, who is so alienated, who at every moment and in every way really just tries to sort of pursue an alternative, liberal, absolutely antithetical lifestyle to what the government wants. So another experience that we had, or that I had in the course of getting married, sort of suggested that in some ways the government is trying to be pragmatic. So I'm just going to tell you briefly about the premarital class that we attended. And you sort of had to go and take blood tests, and you had to have sort of the government official there sign off on the marriage contract that you sort of had done all of these things. And so after the blood test, we were told, well, please go and wait for the premarital class. And I thought, well, it's obviously going to be about contraception, because I had friends, and they said, well, it's just about contraception. So I went to the woman. I said, I went to elementary school in California. I learned all of this there. Can I skip the class? And she said, no, there's really new stuff. You should go and you should sit. It'll be interesting. There might be things you don't know. So I said, fine. And the men and women were separated. So I went into the women's room and I sat there. And it was, it did start out to be a talk about contraception. And she said, well, how many of you know what emergency contraception is? And most of the women didn't really know. And she went on to explain what that was. And it's actually a form of contraception that has been controversial even in the West, in this country. Wasn't widely available maybe 10 years ago here, but is now sort of widely available in Iran. She explained how young women could go into pharmacies. Every woman in the class was sort of given a little pack of all of these different kinds of pills, and she sort of outlined all the different kinds of contraceptive methods that are available. And this is because partly because the government runs a really, really savvy and effective family planning strategy. It's lowered its birth rate very successfully. But I was fairly impressed at how sort of sophisticated all of this was, and how even these sort of most modern of methods were sort of everyone was comfortable with them and being taught about them. And then the conversation shifted, and that's when I was really surprised, because the teacher then started explaining to all of these young women who were of very different backgrounds. There were a few young women in Chador and a few very sort of modern young women, but it was really just a mix. And she began explaining that they should all enjoy the sexual aspect of their marriage. And she was really went to sort of pains to say women's bodies are different. The process for women becoming aroused takes longer than men, and you have to teach your husbands this because it's not something that they might know. And the women were just curious and throwing up their hands and sort of asking really frank questions about sexuality. And the lesson that was sort of imparted to all this is that, you know, even no matter what they've sort of been taught at home or what the traditional idea of sort of feminine sexuality is in this very traditional culture, that women had a right to enjoy sex in their marriage and that they should assert themselves. And I thought it was pretty tremendous that this was the message that was being communicated by the government in its official premarital classes. And what is it responding to? How does this come about? Well, I think it sort of likely has to do with rising divorce rates, because the rate of divorce in Iran is incredibly high, and the government is concerned about this, and is trying to respond to that through encouraging sort of better marriages and sort of trying to step in and sort of help maybe traditional young couples who come from families where these things aren't talked about to sort of guide them along. And it's sort of an instance where it is trying in its own way to respond to the very changing mores and needs of these young people. I think that something that I explore in the book, and I think that these sort of examples bring up, is what is this government and what does it want to be? Does it want to be authoritarian? Does it want to be democratic? Does it care about its popularity, or is it utterly indifferent and willing to be brutal in how it deals with its young people? Does it want to be close to the West and allied with Europe and the United States, or does it want to be a hero of the Islamic world? Does it want to be popular in the rest of the Arab world and the Islamic world? And I think that these are questions that the government hasn't really resolved for itself, and you can see that in very often these very contradictory policies. You can see that in its sort of willingness to be pragmatic about young people's needs and realities in one area and utterly indifferent and quite insensitive to them in others. I write about this in terms of myself, in my experiences as a journalist in Iran, because it's certainly one of the tougher places that I've ever reported from. And it's a theme in my book, what this was like for me. I had a government minder in Iran, like many Iranian journalists do. And we were very often in touch. I had to sort of keep him updated about what stories I was reporting and what I was working on and who my sources were. And sometimes this relationship would be sort of very straightforward, and he would occasionally even be supportive and offer help if there was some sort of bureaucratic obstacle. And was often very realistic. I would say, well, you know, the West wants to know about Iran's relationship to Hamas. I have to report on it. And he would sometimes understand that, and he seemed sort of very pragmatic and realistic. And at other times, he would be a tremendous bully and try to scare me away from reporting a certain story, or in all of the sort of ways at his disposal would make me to feel sort of vulnerable, and that perhaps my own security was at stake, that perhaps my relatives and my friends might be also vulnerable. And so that's sort of another theme that I explore, and I think that it goes back to what I think is the message that I want to get across, is that in Iran, I think it's very easy to caricature Iran as a black and white sort of society and a black and white sort of government that is either entirely repressive, you know, totalitarian. You can put sort of Islamic fascist. There's all sorts of different labels you can put on it. And I don't mean to suggest at all that it's not incredibly repressive, that it doesn't have a brutal human rights record. Of course it does. We all know this. But there are many ways in which that Iranian society has created its own pressures on this government and is forcing it to respond differently. And that also that there are different elements to the Iranian government. It's very fractured. It has a difficult time hammering out policy by consensus because there are very different visions within the government for what kind of country Iran should be, what kind of revolution it had, and where that revolution should go. It's something that people seem to be curious about here, sort of how Iranians view some of their government's foreign policies. So I'll just speak briefly to that, because I think that, especially in this country, Iran is certainly associated with and considered a state sponsor of terror. It's certainly known and talked about as the sort of chief backer of groups like Hezbollah and Hamas and Islamic Jihad. And I think that people are curious to know what Iranians think about this, and do they support their government support for these groups? Where do they stand on that issue? And even though this is sort of a sensitive thing to report about in Iran, I've sort of made it a focus also of my work, because I think it's part of how we can understand Iranians as different from their government. And although there is, you know, very, very real sympathy for Palestinians and their cause, there's really widespread resentment of the government's support for these groups, because there is a sense that the costs for Iran are considerable. I was living in Iran when there was an Israeli-Lebanese war, if you want to call it the sort of conflict of 2006. I'm not sure if you all remember, but it was sort of a month-long conflict, and there was bombing going back and forth. And Iran, of course, in its state television, was covering all of this very closely. Every night there would be footage on television of sort of Lebanese casualties. And people were actually getting really frustrated by this. And I remember one morning very early going to the neighborhood bakery to buy fresh bread. And I got there and there were sort of other neighbors sort of lining up and everyone was waiting for fresh bread and the bakery was closed. And we waited and waited and sort of it became obvious that it wasn't going to open. And so people began to sort of speculate, why is the bakery closed? And then suddenly the idea was seized upon that the government has sent all of the country's flour to Lebanon. They've given away our flour. They've given it to the Lebanese because they want to support Hezbollah, and now we don't have bread. And this was sort of discussed, and everyone got very angry, and they said, well, what are they going to give them next, and why do we have to help them when we're suffering so much, and we're not even Arab. Why are the Arabs not helping? Why do we have to suffer all of the cost of supporting the Palestinians when the Arab states aren't even doing anything? And it turned out that the bakery was simply remodeling. There had been... There had been no sort of massive drop of flour to Lebanon that had resulted in a shortage of Iranian flour. But it just sort of goes to illustrate how resentful people are of these relationships, of the government's strategy of extending its influence throughout the Middle East by backing these kind of groups, and how unpopular that is, actually. And so these kind of relationships are certainly what will be on the negotiating table if the Iranian government does sit down with the Obama administration and sort of try and see if it can hammer out some points of commonality. It's something that the Iranian government knows complicates its position because it doesn't have popular support for a lot of these policies. And this is partly why I'm personally hopeful that there might be some chance of some sort of, I don't imagine there will be some sort of grand solution, because I think that the gulf between the U.S. and Iran is a very wide one, 30 years in the making. And the policy differences and the issues that need to be resolved are incredibly thorny and difficult to unravel. But I think that there's also a lot of common ground. The two countries share Iraq and Afghanistan as very central security interests. There's a shared need to work against Sunni terrorist groups like Al Qaeda, which are a threat to Iran as well. And so there's a lot there to work out, but there are areas of commonality. And I do hope that there will be some sort of progress on the diplomatic front, because Iranians have really suffered in the past 3 or 4 years from the really deteriorated relations that we've seen between the two countries under President Ahmadinejad and under President Bush. It's something we can talk about maybe later in questions, but the U.S. has had a sort of stated policy of trying to democratize Iran through funding for NGOs and civil society, and that's had really the effect of making the Iranian government more paranoid than it already is, and has really frozen any kind of civil society activity that we've had in the last decade, really, whether it's environmental NGOs or women's groups or media watchdog types groups. I mean, civil society in Iran is obviously very nascent and very wobbly still. And the government also very suspicious of what its sort of real intentions are. Like any authoritarian government, it doesn't really quite understand the concept of having a civil society. And it hasn't really helped that the Bush administration sort of put aside all of these millions of dollars for exporting democracy to Iran, because that really just made the entire NGO sector and a lot of women's groups considered suspect, and it led to a really widespread crackdown. So I'll end with the thought that I think that people in Iran are very excited about Obama, not just because he has the middle name Hussein, which is obviously to any kind of Muslim country quite fascinating that a man with that name could be elected president, but a real hope that he will sort of address Iran respectfully and at least be respectful in his tone to the Iranian people, no matter how serious his concern is about Iran's leadership and its government. So I think I'll end there, and maybe we can take questions and talk about what you're more interested in.
Thank you. I am Dr. Shahin Yerani. My coordinator of women's studies at San Jose State University, and I will be your host to monitor this session. I am allowed to do one infomercial. We have some flyers about Women's History Month during the month of March. Scheduled by our program at San Jose State, they are free and open to public. I hope you take advantage of those and look at those flyers. Now I will ask some of the questions if we have time, and ask Azad to tell us more. I try to put a theme through these, so we see how far we get. Azadeh, my daughter is an inspiring journalist. Do you have any advice for her as we see newspapers and print media on the decline?
Wow, well, it's something that that's a little bit hard to talk about because it's hard for me to balance giving encouraging advice to young people and aspiring journalists while being very realistic about the economic climate and where the industry is right now. My first advice is not to spend $40,000 on journalism graduate school because that's not going to pay off anytime soon. I think that journalism is certainly a craft, and it can be learned, and it can be learned through practice. And there's no need to go to an expensive program to get a start. I think that getting sort of valuable experience, whether it's at the university paper or through internships, is a really important way to get a start. Because very often the reality of working in print, for example, as opposed to broadcast journalism, even radio, although it's sort of all broadly reporting, it's so incredibly different. And I think it's really important to get a sense of what's a right fit for an aspiring journalist. I, for example, could never do radio. I could never do, well, I probably could, but I really would not like to, or television. But my home is my home is print journalism, and particularly sort of long format print journalism. And I think that also getting international experience is a great way ahead too, because all of these newspapers and magazines are now shutting down their foreign bureaus, which means that they do need reporters freelancing out there in the field. So if one were to sort of pick a pretty safe country that also has a good news story, that's a really great way, I think, to get a start as well.
Okay, thank you. Why is the Iranian theocracy so bent on destroying the Persian culture and history? And Azadeh, why do so many Iranian expats associate themselves with the Persian culture, not Iranian?
Uh-huh.
You hear that often.
Well, I'm happy to say that I write about this in the book. I think that the Iranian government established itself as an Islamic government and didn't really believe in nationhood, and sort of the idea was that there would be a supranational sort of leader of the Islamic world, and shouldn't be preoccupied with just being a silly nation state with a sort of 2,500-year-old history, and so I think that's why we've seen this sort of 30-year-long assault on pre-Islamic traditions, whether it's trying to raise down the ruins at Persepolis, whether it's banning Zoroastrian names, whether it's trying to marginalize pre-Islamic holidays. I think that there's a real battle over Iranian identity and what part of that, how important the Islamic side, the Islamic Shia side of Iranian identity is as compared to its pre-Islamic side. And there was a last part to that question.
Why do the expats identify themselves as Persians rather than Iranian?
Oh, I think just to distance themselves from the really ugly reality or the ugly associations of modern Iran, sort of post-revolutionary Iran. Although I think revolutionary Iran should have no claim on Iranianness, and I very proudly say that I'm Iranian, because I think that Persian sounds sort of, well, I think that people who enjoy saying that should, but to me, Iran is not just the Islamic Republic, and we should reclaim that word and that name for ourselves as well.
I have a 13-year-old that had a T-shirt said Iranian, and with magic markers, she
crossed and then wrote Persian, because everybody else in her class was doing it. So that's interesting.
If Iranians are becoming increasingly unhappy, will we see a change in government? Does Ahmadinejad still have support of the mullahs?
Does he have support of the mullahs? I think that a sort of there certainly is a faction within the establishment that supports him. He has a lot of support in in the Revolutionary Guards, and it seems pretty clear that excuse my cough. It seems pretty clear that the supreme leader is sort of content enough with him until now, although I think things are very fluid in Iranian politics, and that may change in the next few months. But I think that there are also significant and powerful parts of the regime that are very dissatisfied with him. They think that his presidency has been a failure and that he's just a problem. So I think that that he doesn't really have the support of government on the whole.
This question follows that one, Azadeh. Can you talk a bit about the upcoming presidential election scheduled for June? And who do you think will have a chance?
Well, in June, I think the main candidates are, of course, Ahmadinejad, the incumbent, and Mohammad Khatami, who was president before Ahmadinejad for two terms and who's considered the moderate in the Iranian context, will be running. There's also the mayor of Tehran, Mr. Ghalibaf, who is also a conservative, but a much better conservative than Ahmadinejad, if you can say such a thing. He's a pilot. He has a PhD. I mean, he's actually a fairly well-educated man who has a good record in management. He's been running Tehran well compared to Ahmadinejad. And there's actually a very colorful sort of battle already going on between them. The mayor is trying to win a lot of support ahead of the election for himself by really attending to Tehran. So for the first time, I think, in years, if your street has a pothole and you call up the municipality, there will be someone there that week to take care of your pothole. And it's interesting. I mean, if that's what it takes, if sort of political rivalry is going to lead to more accountable government, well, that can only be a good thing. But I think that certainly if there isn't sort of major tampering with the vote, the Khatami will win, because I think people appreciate how much more open Iranian life was under his presidency.
Are you able to keep in touch with your sources in Iran? What changes have occurred under the Ahmadinejad government since you left? So two questions. Mm-hmm. One is still, what changes happened since you left regarding Ahmadinejad, following mm-hmm. the other two questions? And can you keep in touch with your sources?
Well, I try to go back more often, as often as I can, because a lot of times sources are reluctant to have sort of candid conversations on the phone, so there's only really so much that you can communicate by phone. So I try to go back pretty regularly, and I was there just this past December. when I moved away from Iran in 2007, I think that sort of Ahmadinejad had pretty much unleashed everything that he had in him on the Iranian economy and people. So things haven't changed too dramatically since I left, but there can still be very long lines for gas. There are still the white morality police bands patrolling the streets. Parties still get raided more frequently than they did in previous years. I think women are forced to dress a little bit more conservatively. A friend of mine actually lost her teaching job because they had sort of reinstated these tests for, you know, are you pious enough? And so all the teachers had to go pray and show that they were pious, and she didn't pray properly. So there's definitely that sort of drive to sort of re-Islamicize schools, ministries, encouraging people to pray together at work, and a lot of these things that had been retired during the 8 years of Khatami.
You mentioned in your book, Azadeh, the increased cost of living in Tehran, and you have used the example of fruit, I remember that. How can regular Iranians cope with this high cost of living?
A lot of them cope by working two or three jobs. It's really quite exhausting to be able to support a family in Tehran, and a lot of people will work one job during the day. They might drive a taxi in the evening. They might have some sort of shared sort of money-making scheme or sort of some other kind of effort with their friends. And so people just exhaust themselves, really. they try to move neighborhoods so that they can have lower rent. They eat less meat to keep their costs down. It's incredibly difficult.
As a mother, do you feel raising a child under the influence of Western culture is more challenging? Or compared to Iran, which one would you find more challenging? And I'm going to combine two questions because of the time. And what would be the biggest problem raising a son in Iran or a daughter? So which one would be more challenging and which one would be easier to raise in Iran, a son or a daughter? Sorry, I'm combining question to cover as many as we can. Go ahead.
Well, I think the challenges are very different. I think that in Iran, what's easier is balancing motherhood and work, because I think that there's a whole traditional support network of family there to help you be able to have a career and also be a mother in a way that I think doesn't really exist in the West, because people work, families are far apart, and there just isn't a culture of families being so tight-knit and being able to help a young mother raise her child in the same way. I think in Iran there's still very much the it takes a village mentality, and everyone has their village sort of right around them. And I think that that's what makes it possible for women to balance work and motherhood and family. What's tough in Iran is obviously, I think, trying to impart secular, liberal, sort of free-thinking values to a young child who is going to school and is being brought up in this very restrictive environment. Where there are sort of people at school who are teaching one thing and people and the family at home who's teaching another. I have a good friend in Tehran who has twin boys, actually. And one day, one of them came home from school and said, "You're really immoral," to his mother. And she said, "Why am I immoral?" She said, "Because you don't wear the chador. You don't wear the black chador. You don't respect our culture." And so he was just parroting what he had heard that day. And I think she very quickly sort of disabused him of this idea. But it's still a constant struggle, I think, to sort of make sure that you are challenging at every moment the messages that your child might be getting outside the home. And then would it be easier to raise
A son or a daughter?
Oh, I don't know. I think they're both sort of uniquely difficult in their own way.
I agree.
In Iran.
What was your wedding like? And I'm going to keep the rest of this question because it's about Ahmadinejad. So what was your wedding like?
My wedding by Iranian standards was very small. It was about 120 people. and I will tell you that the month before I went to a wedding that was 1,000 people. So we had a modest, we tried to have a modest wedding. And the big sort of issue for us was, you know, can we serve alcohol and how are we going to get enough wine for 120 people? Because, of course, alcohol is illegal, and being able to get that much alcohol at once is sort of a feat. So we had to call all our different bootlegging friends and see. And some of them thought that it was a trap, and they said, 60 cases of wine, do you think I'm a fool? And would hang up the phone. And so it was a challenge, but we managed in the end, and we had we didn't have to have a gender segregated wedding, fortunately, because we had it at home, and so everyone could be together.
So why are Iranians so enamored by these huge extravagant weddings?
Well, my personal reading of it is that that because Iran is not a meritocracy, to be a successful individual, you pretty much have to have relations to the regime. If you want to be a successful businessman, if you want to have a decent job even in a university, for example, your connections to those in power have to be pretty good. And so it's not enough to just be intelligent and hardworking. You can be an intelligent, hardworking, really talented engineer with an MA, for example, and still be really poor. You can't even afford to go to a restaurant. And so I think that sort of prestige and social status is hard to come by through sort of traditional avenues of hard work and education. And so I think that material displays of success, well, at least you can just buy that. It's pretty straightforward. You don't have to know anyone to ultimately be able to buy or to spend that way on a wedding. And so it's an opportunity to sort of establish your status before all of your peers and before your community.
Also, the Iranian government didn't try to stop you and your family from leaving the country. What is your view of the exodus of the young, educated Iranians?
I just think it's Iran's great tragedy that its best and brightest every year leave the country, and that there's this tremendous brain drain, and that all of these bright and talented Iranians are succeeding in other societies rather than contributing to their own. But the government actually seems to enjoy their success. Actually, on the nightly news, whenever an Iranian sort of has some sort of great accomplishment or discovers some important cure for a disease, on the nightly news, they're very excited about it. And they sort of, you know, and tonight, you know, an Iranian in Canada cured AIDS. and there will be this really ecstatic sort of coverage of it, and sort of very nationalistic, as though this were not though the very government that had driven out that really talented researcher or doctor. So I think that's really one of the most tragic things about the revolution.
What would be the future of Islamic Republic of Iran? And following that, combining two questions, does Ahmadinejad have a limited term of office?
Unfortunately, he gets 4 years like any other president. So if he gets reelected, he'll have another 4 years. So that's just sort of standard for him, like everyone else. The future of the Islamic Republic, wow. I think it'll just be a slow process of gradual change, and I think it might be generations before we see Iran as a sort of stable, democratic, open society. I think that change is not going to be very quick. But what gives me hope is that I think that Iran sort of has a lot of the qualities that it needs already to move ahead very quickly once there is the right kind of leadership in place. Young people are very educated, literacy is high, healthcare is not so bad. I mean, this is not sort of an impoverished, illiterate society by any means. So Iran sort of has the capability, I think, to move quickly once its leadership is on track.
Azadeh, what do you think that the young Iranian population is their view of the nuclear goals? What do you think they perceive the nuclear goals of the government?
In Iran, I don't think that there's a really honest debate about the nuclear program. It's not like the government that controls sort of state television and radio sits down and says, well, we're enriching uranium, and we really don't need to do that, but we have this agenda to be hegemonic in the region, and so we're willing to withstand sanctions to do that. It's not an open debate, so people aren't really aware of the repercussions of all of this. They don't understand that if Iran were to at least postpone your uranium enrichment, for example, these sanctions would be very well likely lifted and the economy would improve. So given how little they know, the issue has just been cast as one of national pride and sovereign right. And it can be a forceful argument that why can Pakistan that's sort of about to fall apart and is actually, I mean, if there is a country that is more likely to give a nuclear weapon to a terrorist group, it is Pakistan. So why can they have one and we can't? And that's the way that it's sort of sold to the Iranian people. So they tend to be sort of very supportive of the program and of Iran's rights to have a program. But I think that if it were sort of packaged and spun differently, they might have a very different attitude.
And I think this answered the other question, that is there a popular support for a development of nuclear power? That's was another, so I combined those two. Can you discuss the educational system in Iran and how is it different or similar to the U.S.?
From what I know about the educational system, and I won't pretend to have a lot of expertise on this, it's to a certain extent, it in certain ways has improved. A friend of mine who has young children says, well, at least the books now have color. At least now there are music lessons in schools. At least they don't regularly sort of ask young people anymore, well, raise your hands if your parents drink alcohol at home. That's how things used to be. And it's better than that. It's not quite like that anymore, but it is still, to some extent, ideological. Textbooks will have very religious families at their center, and the religious family who's sort of center of learning, sort of core textbook, will go on pilgrimages, and they'll eat on the floor. And when they go to Shiraz, they don't go to Persepolis. That's the sort of view of things that young people learn. I guess if the question is sort of more broad as to, is there a decent university system? Well, I think there's very strong undergraduate programs in engineering and the hard sciences, but in fact, a lot of those young people go on to sort of graduate programs at Stanford and MIT, and they do very well. So there is sort of a part of the university system that does well, although at the sort of postgraduate level, it's not at all as impressive.
What did your husband learn in the premarital class?
Everyone always asks that. I think I should just start mentioning it. Well, they had a cartoon. We didn't have a cartoon. They had a cartoon that sort of taught them all of the contraceptive things. And then they were taught that for women, sex is a very emotional experience and that they should attend to their wife's emotional needs as part of that part of their marriage as well, not just turn over and go to sleep.
This question has several parts. Why blood tests for marriage? And then how many women are elected to office? And can women be sentenced for flaunting laws on dress or punished for violating the dress code?
The blood tests are, I think they're meant to sort of pick up, specifically, they're the blood disorder common to people who are ethnically Iranian. And they just want to make sure that two people who carry that blood type, I think, that would have, it's a type of hemophilia and can lead to, I think, birth defects. So it's partly just to make sure that both partners don't have that because it could have implications for their children. What was the second part?
Woman elected to office and, again, violation of dress code.
Women, Iran certainly does have women in parliament. It does have female ministers. A woman can't run for president. That's certainly the case. The number of women that have been in Iranian parliaments in previous years hasn't been bad. I mean, it's comparable to places in the West where, like, I think Italy, I actually researched this at a point. I mean, it's a sort of respectable number. I mean, it's not like Scandinavia or anything, but you could at least have sort of, I think, 15 women perhaps out of don't ask me how many people are in the parliament, but it's
345.
There we go. but that said, sometimes they're very conservative women who have regressive policies on women's issues. So it's not always sort of the fact that there are all these women in parliament does not mean that there's a sort of liberal women's agenda in parliament. And women can be punished for flouting the dress code. They can be flogged. They can be fined. They can go to prison. Very often, none of these things happen, but sometimes it can, and sometimes it does.
Okay, now it's picking. How was the reaction of the people to you as an American, and? But you fearful for your safety because you were a journalist.
People are very fond of America. so mostly if I would say, well, I grew up in America and now I'm here. And they would say, why did you come back? So they're very fond of America. They're not so fond of the UK. I told a taxi driver in December that I lived in London, and he was outraged. He said, could you find a more despicable place to live? So it's quite unique, I think, the sort of positive attitudes that there are sort of for the U.S. in particular. Sorry.
And how did they treat you, because you were a journalist?
How did they treat me? Well, I sort of alluded to that a little bit in my talk. I think that being a journalist in Iran is really tough, and you're constantly having to deal with the government in different ways. And sometimes the government can be supportive and very sort of smart and respectful in the way that it treats journalists, and sometimes it can be incredibly intimidating and bullying, and it is both of these things, and I've experienced both.
Is Iran really bent on destroying the state of Israel, and what a step would they take?
Well, I'll just answer this by saying that if Iran had a nuclear bomb today, I don't think that they would use it against Israel. The Iranian government, although ideological, is not so fanatical and mad and irresponsible to do something like that. I think that it's very content to use its support for groups like Hamas as a card that it will use in negotiations with the U.S. And I think there's certainly an awareness in the Iranian government that at some point it will have to give up those relationships for the sake of better ties with the West. And there's a sort of realistic attitude about that. And I think we have to remember that before the revolution, Iran was close allies with Israel. And there are sort of interests, sort of strategic interests in the Middle East that might make that perhaps not sort of a viable case today, but at least sort of a very likely scenario in which there's a sort of neutral relationship where there's not this sort of enmity. But I think it's a revolutionary slogan, and not to sort of discount support for groups like Hamas, but I think it has to be sort of viewed in context, and it's not a real objective for the Iranian government.
Okay, we have time for one question, and I'm going to combine these two because they are really interesting. Some of you have seen Rick Steves' film that traveled to Iran on PBS, and the question is that what do you think of that? And combining that, how can someone travel to Iran? And one place would you recommend that somebody has to see when they go to Iran?
Mm-hmm. Well, I only found out this morning that Rick Steves had gone to Iran, which I think is fantastic news, because I think that Iran is a tourist paradise because it has sort of world-class tourism and very few tourists go. So it's sort of your own private experience and when you do. So I think it's great that he's promoting that, because Iranians are incredibly gracious and hospitable and they love tourists, and it would be good for their economy. So I think that's only a positive thing. As far as I know, Americans have to get visas through travel agencies. It has to be sort of part of a package tour, and it's not that easy to just get your own tourist visa. So I think it has to go through some kind of agency. I don't know, I couldn't just pick one place. I mean, I would absolutely have to go to both Isfahan and Shiraz, and I think that to understand Iran, you have to go to both places. So.
Okay. I think that's our time. And
well, I hope you all enjoyed today's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Azadeh Moveni, author of Honeymoon in Tehran, Dr. Shaheen Ghirami, Director of Women's Studies at San Jose State University, our audience here in San Jose, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley is adjourned.